his husband. Let's continue to remember Betty Ann and Debbie and the rest of the family in our prayers. Let's continue to remember them. Come back and be with us this evening. Drew Gibbs will be preaching. This will be the last in his summer program. And he'll be preaching on What is the Hurry? Come back and be a part of that study tonight. Drew has done an excellent job with us this summer. It's been a pleasure working with him. The two things I look for when a young man is preaching and I critique when I'm talking to him the next day is the material scriptural and is it true to the book? Every sermon has been. And is it well organized? And every sermon has been. And I appreciate so much the work he has done. He's growing in his confidence. You can see that with each lesson that he presents. Come back and be a part of the study tonight. It's been good to have him in the summer program this year. Let's open our Bibles now to the 18th chapter of the book of Matthew. Perhaps you will recall, as we have studied Matthew many times, that chapter 18 stands out as a chapter that deals with our relationships. We've been dealing with relationships in the book of Romans because chapter 12 through 16 deals with the Christian and his relationships. Matthew 18 talks a great deal about that, but it gives us a different angle and a different insight to those relationships. There are several things throughout Matthew chapter 18, and we're going to look at all of those in probably two or three lessons. But I want us to begin by talking about how that problems in relationships come because of a number of reasons. Sometimes problems in our relationships with other people come because we're focusing on ourselves. We saw that in chapter 15 of Romans this morning, where we might be focusing on ourselves more than focusing on the needs of others. Well, that causes relationship problems. Here's another reason. Sometimes because of pride, when we're swelled up and we feel that we may be superior to somebody because of race, because of education, because of material status, we may feel we're superior to someone, maybe abilities that we have. Another thing that causes relationship problems is maybe we don't value another person. Maybe we don't view them as being of great importance in the greater scheme of things. Or maybe we don't see that God views them as important as God would perhaps view me. And so we don't value them as we should. Well, another problem could be we don't resolve differences when differences come about, and there will be in relationships. We let them fester and we let them brew rather than resolving those differences, rather than trying to work those out and finding out, can we have a common ground where we can work our differences at? And because of those differences, another problem sometimes that arises is we fail to forgive. Someone has done us wrong. They may even ask for forgiveness, and we fail to forgive them, and we still hold that against them, and therefore now we have relationship problems. In our context, I want you to notice Jesus dealt with every one of these. Let's start with the first. In chapter 17 of the book of Matthew, verse 23, we see the disciples were exceedingly sorrowful. What that tells me is they were sorrowful for Christ, and their focal point at that point of our study is they're focusing on Christ. But by the time we get to chapter 18 and in verse 1, their focus is turned from Christ to themselves. No longer are they looking at Him, they're looking at themselves. And they ask the question, who is the greatest in the kingdom? Jesus addresses that question of focusing on self. But He focused on the question of pride. Look at verse 4. He said that you should humble yourself as a little child. We'll see that more in just a moment. He focused on the problem of pride. Well, sometimes we don't value one another. So beginning at verse 10 of chapter 18, he talks the value of the lost sheep, and he talks about the value of one soul. But that's not all he talks about. Beginning at verse 15 through 17, he talks about resolving our differences. You remember that discussion about if your brother has sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. Gaining your brother, that's resolving differences. And here's the method, and here's the way you go about doing that. And then, notice beginning at verse 21 to the end of the chapter, he talks about forgiveness. If a brother sins against you, Peter said, if a man sins against me, shall I forgive him? Peter thought he was going to be quite liberal in the matter. And come to find out, he wasn't liberal enough. Now, I want us to focus today on the first 9 verses. And the question being raised in verses 1 through 9 is, who is the greatest? That was the question the disciples were raising. So I encourage you to get your Bible and let's read together verses 1 through 9 of Matthew chapter 18. And this question that they had about who is the greatest. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who then is the greatest in the kingdom?" Then Jesus called a little child to him and set him in the midst of them. And he said, "Assuredly, I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him that a millstone were hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depth of the sea. Woe to the world because of offenses, for offenses must come, but woe to the man by whom offenses come. If your hand or foot causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life lame or maimed than having two hands or two feet to be cast into everlasting fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter life with one eye rather than having two eyes to be cast into hell fire." Now that's Matthew's account of that. And let's go now to Mark's account, and Mark's is a little briefer than that. That's why we always seem to focus on Matthew's account. But Mark tells us some things that Matthew doesn't. So let's turn to Mark 9, 33 to 37. And let's see some things that Matthew did not record for us. Came to Capernaum. When he was in the house, he asked them, "What was it you disputed among yourselves on the road?" Matthew didn't tell us. They'd been disputing along the way, and that Jesus is the one who asked them about that. Matthew says they came to Jesus with a question. Verse 34 is interesting, and we'll make a point about this later. Notice, they kept silent, for on the road they had disputed among themselves who would be the greatest. And he sat down and called the 12, and he said to them, "If anyone desires to be first, let him be last of all and servant of all." And he took a little child and set him in the midst of them. And when he had taken him into his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one of these little ones in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me." Now, Mark didn't tell a whole story. He didn't tell everything that Matthew did, but he told us a little bit that Matthew has not told us. But that's not all. Luke gets even briefer than that. And let's see what Luke says. And this is in Luke, the 9th chapter, beginning at verse 46 through 48, only 3 verses devoted to Luke's account. "Then a dispute arose among them as to which would be the greatest." Let's stop there just for a moment. That's interesting to me, that a dispute had arose. Not that a question just arose, but a dispute had arose among them. And they were arguing and disputing over who is the greatest. I don't know if it was one saying, "I think I am," or, "Oh, no, it's not me, but it seems to be you. It seems to be more I." Focus, because that's what Jesus responds to in chapter 18 of Matthew. But anyway, verse 47, Jesus perceiving their thoughts, thought of their heart, he took a child and said, him by him. And he said, "Whoever receives this little child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For he who is least among you all will be great." Luke says even less than the rest. So let's talk about this question, about who is the greatest. And there are 3 things I want us to consider. And the first thing, let's focus on the question of verse 1. Let's go back to Matthew 18 and notice at verse 1 in Matthew 18 what the question was. The disciples came to Jesus and they said, "Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" Now that seems like a strange question, doesn't it? So that makes us raise this question. What could have prompted such a question? Is there anything in the context that tells me what might have prompted that question? Well, let's go outside the context first and then we'll come back into the context. Let's turn to the 22nd chapter of the book of Luke. What might have prompted that question was a misunderstanding concerning the nature of the kingdom itself. You remember that most, including the disciples, had a concept that the kingdom was a materialistic kingdom, a kingdom on earth, where Jesus would have been a literal king and there would have been a literal throne and there would have been servants and there would have been various levels of authority in the kingdom. And so they had that kind of concept. So notice this in Luke chapter 22, if you will, beginning at verse 24. Through verse 27, particularly verse 24, that there was a rivalry among them as to who should be considered the greatest. I'm not going to read the rest of that, but the context shows what their question was when they're asking who is the greatest had to do with reference to the nature of the kingdom. reckon who will be second under command under the king. We know Jesus must be the king, but reckon who's done second in command. Reckon who's going to sit in that spot. Reckon who'll get to be the treasurer. Reckon Matthew will be the treasurer. He probably will, since he is, after all, a publican, and he probably will get that spot. But Peter seems to be that outspoken man. Well, reckon he'll get that kind of Secretary of State position, or reckon he'll be kind of VP under the king, or whatever that role may be. Who's going to be his right-hand man? Who's going to be sitting at the throne with him? And so, there is this great dispute over the nature of the kingdom. Now, let's go to Matthew chapter 20. And there is a parallel account in Mark chapter 10. And what's interesting is, what I want you to see is that position and power have always been attractive to humanity. In Matthew's account of this, this was where the sons of Zebedee had this great ambition. And Matthew's account is a little different from Mark's account. Mark's account, we won't turn there, but Mark's account of this said that James and John came to Jesus and they asked for position. Could one of us sit on the right hand and the other on the left in your kingdom? We want prominent positions in your kingdom. Again, this materialistic, earthly kingdom. And we want prominent positions. What Matthew's account says is that their mother came. And she asked, saying, beginning at verse 20, she kneeling down and asked Jesus, "Who do you wish?" The mother came kneeling down, and she said to him, "That would you grant this, that one of them sat on the right hand and one sat on the left hand in your kingdom?" That's what I want for my sons. And that's all in the background of our question that's being asked. Now, let's talk about some immediate things in the context and the circumstances in Matthew chapter 18. What are some things that happened just previous to this question in verse 1 of chapter 18 that might have prompted this? Well, let's back up a few chapters. Let's go back to chapter 16. Jealousy must have been growing. And you say, what might have prompted that jealousy? Well, there was a statement made to Peter that was also later identified in chapter 18 to all the apostles. But at this juncture, Jesus said it specifically to Peter when he said that, "Peter, I say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it, and I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven." Now, that applied to all the apostles, but he said that to Peter. Could that have stirred some jealousy? Well, let's see. Let's go a little further. Let's go to the 17th chapter now. And in chapter 17, there is the Mount of Transfiguration. And do you remember that in the Transfiguration that Jesus took three with him, and he took those three alone, and that means nine were not allowed. There was Peter, James, and John. I can begin to see why some might begin to... He said that to Peter. You remember him saying that to Peter over there? He didn't say that to the rest of us specifically. He addressed Peter when he said that. And then when he went to the mountain, he took Peter, James, and John. And I bet you those three are going to get the top three positions in the kingdom. I just bet you they are. And I bet I'm going to be left out. Can you see the jealousy beginning to build? It must be, because chapter 18 reflects that. Now go to chapter 17 and in verse 24. That when the question came up about the temple tax, who did they address? They addressed Peter. They came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the temple tax?" They didn't ask Matthew. He was the tax collector, by the way. But they asked Peter. Notice, beginning at verse 24, that Peter was the one appointed to a special miracle. You remember the miracle? Yeah, we'll pay the temple tax. So here's what you do. You go to the sea and catch the fish. And the first fish that you catch, there'll be a coin in his mouth, and you take it and you deliver and pay our tax with the coin. Now, Peter was the one that got to do that. Could some jealousy be building? Well, you remember Luke 22 said they were disputing among themselves who would be the greatest. Chapter 17 goes on. In chapter 17, beginning at verse 24, about the question of paying the temple tax, there was discussion about earthly kings. And following that, the question then comes, who then is the greatest in the kingdom? They must be motivated. Had to be motivated by what's in it for me. And you say, evidence? Did not Peter raise that question himself? In Matthew chapter 19, a little bit later, what's in it for me? We've given up all. And what do we get out of this? Remember that? Matthew 19. They were driven by this motive of what's in this for me? Would I get a chief spot in the kingdom somehow? That must be what has kind of prompted this question. Now, I want to go secondly. Now, knowing a little bit about what might have prompted that question. And I think because of the context of Matthew 18, that tells me their question was not, I don't think I'm the greatest, but I think you probably are the greatest. And, oh, certainly not me. It wasn't out of humility that someone else besides me, but it must have been a little bit that I think probably I'll get that spot and I may be more important and I hope I get the chief spot in the kingdom. Promoting self. And I want you to consider with me how that must have been disappointing to Jesus. And why that would have been disappointing to hear this question. Can you imagine being in his position and your disciples that you've been with all of this time, they come to you and they ask, we want to know who is the greatest in the kingdom. Why would that have been so disappointing? That would have been so disappointing because Jesus never preached self-advancement. He never preached self-promotion. He always preached and he always lived humility. He had never displayed this kind of spirit before them. They didn't learn that from him. That must have been disappointing. There was never a greater pattern of humility than with Jesus. And they're not imitating that at all. They're not displaying that at all. Jesus spoke very little about his glory. He spoke a great deal about his suffering. He did in chapter 16. You remember that? And they seemed to ignore his suffering. And they seemed to focus on his glory and the glory of his kingdom. Back to chapter 16. He had just recently taught them in chapter 16, just a few days before. He's taught them to learn to deny themselves. If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. He had just told them just recently that if you want to be my disciple, you've got to learn to say no to yourself. They're not doing that in chapter 18. Not doing that at all. And the fact that they asked the question in Matthew chapter 18 shows they have no idea what the kingdom is about. And he's been with them all this time. And he's been explaining it to them, and they still don't get the point. How disappointing that must have been. Some of you who have been teachers must be able to identify that you've been with a class, and you've taught them, and you've taught them, and you've taught them, and then as it gets toward the middle of the year or toward the end of the year, they still don't get it. And you think, where have you been? What's going on? I tried to drive this point home, and you don't get the point. And how Jesus must have been disappointed. Now, they also were a little disappointed in that. Remember I said we'd come back and make a point from Mark 9? Go with me to Mark 9, if you will. Because there's a little disappointment in their own eyes. How so? I put here that they have some shame. Oh, they weren't really ashamed, but they had some degree of shame. Because remember in Mark's account, when he said, I'm reading in verse 33, what was it you were disputing about along the way? He knew, but he wanted them to tell him. You ever do that as a parent? You know what the child's doing, but you ask him what to do because you want them to tell you. There's a little bit of pain in having to tell it. He wants them to tell it. Verse 34. They kept silent because they were disputing about who is the greatest. They didn't want Jesus to know that. How disappointing that must have been to Jesus. Now, I want to suggest to you that they were behaving like schoolyard children, were they not? Like a bunch of kids that are scuffling and beginning to argue and fighting over. That's how the disciples were behaving. These are the men that are going to carry the gospel to the world. How disappointed he must have been. Now, before we get too far in our condemnation of the disciples, I want to suggest to you that we could be asking the same question, could we not? We would never think of going to the Lord and saying, Lord, I want to know who is the greatest in the kingdom. Kind of reminds me of the preacher who came to Middle Tennessee a number of years ago. And there were a couple of young preachers here in the state at the time, and neither one of them live in the area now, but as they took him to the airport, he kept asking them, who do y'all think is the best preacher in the brotherhood? And they didn't know. There's some good preachers around. And he kept driving. Who do you think is the best, though? And they got finally the picture that he must have been wanting them to say that he was. Would you ever ask that question? Who is the best Christian around? Who's the greatest Christian? Who's the greatest in the kingdom? We'd never ask that question, would we? But what I want to suggest to you is that any time we ask a question or we engage in some action or a statement that is driven from selfish ambition, we're asking the same question. Because their motive was, what's in it for me? What's in it for me? What am I going to get out of this? How is the kingdom going to benefit me? Not spiritually, but how is it going to make me better? Any question we ever raise, anything we ever do that's driven by selfish ambition, we're asking the same question. We're no better than they are. Anytime we have that attitude of what's in it for me, I'm asked to perform some task, I'm asked to do something in the kingdom, but what am I going to get out of that? Well, we're asking the same question, are we not? That is a selfish ambition. When we focus on ourselves, more than focusing on others, is that not the same question the disciples were asking? Anytime there is jealousy or envy, are we not asking that same question that they did? Oh, the question is important. But what is more important is the answer he gave in verses 2 through 4. So let's look at the answer in verses 2 through 4. Here was the first thing that he did. And that is, he set a child in their midst. Go back to Matthew 18 and notice in verse 2. Notice the immediate response. Jesus, we've got a question for you. And I think you can settle this. The question is, who is the greatest in the kingdom? And he calls over a little child, and he sets a child in their midst. What a surprising answer. A child? No, maybe he misunderstood the question, they must be thinking. We're wanting to know who is the greatest in the kingdom. And he brings a child out? What did he do with the child? Matthew says he set him in their midst, right in the center of these disciples. Luke says he took Mark says he took him in his arms, and Luke says he had the child by him, which suggests to me it was a very small child that Jesus could take up into his arms, according to Mark's account. What a surprising answer. He calls a child over that he can pick up and he can hold. They must have been expecting a discussion of their names, and he starts talking about a little child. What a surprise. You think about that. You get all set ready. Maybe I'm just bracing for him to mention Peter. I know it's going to be Peter. I know he's going to mention Peter. But after all, wait a minute, it may not be Peter. Remember, he has this very close relationship with John. After all, he's kin to John, you know. He'll probably name John. I just know he's the favored one. But then, you know, James went with him up on the mount. It could be him. I'm ready for him to mention some name, and he doesn't mention a single name. Can you imagine asking the Lord, who do you think is the most important and most valuable Christian in this local church? And you just get ready for your name to be mentioned somewhere in the list, and Jesus brings out a little child. What a surprising answer. You think about the fact that a child surrounded by 12 grown men must have looked so insignificant. And that was the point. That was the point. He is trying to say that you need to be like this little child. This child seems so insignificant in the midst of these grown men standing around, and you need to make yourself so insignificant. What a surprising answer. But that's not all. I want you to notice verse 3. He set a child in their midst. But he's going to say something about that. But here's the first thing he says at verse 3. I assuredly say to you, unless you are converted and become as a little child. Jesus said, you've got to be converted first. You want to know who's going to be the greatest? I'll tell you. You, first of all, have to be converted. He is not speaking of conversion in the sense of obedience to the gospel. He is not saying, you've got to hear the gospel and believe and repent and be baptized. That is not his point. That doesn't even fit in the context. It is true, we can apply that verse to conversion. You have to be converted into the kingdom, but that's not the point. His point to the disciples is, you've got to change. This attitude that you have has to change. It has to change completely. You've got to completely change your thinking if you want to be great in the kingdom. Because the attitude you have now is not great. The attitude you have now stinks. You have to completely change. You've got to give up your selfish ambition and your pride and your thinking and focusing on yourself. You've got to give all of that up if you want to be great in the kingdom. Your attitude is all wrong Your whole premise is flawed, he said. You don't even understand what the kingdom is about. You're not ready to answer this question, who's the greatest? Because you don't even understand the nature of the kingdom. So you want to know what you've got to do to be great? Look at this little child. You've got to be converted. You have to change completely and become like this little child if you want to be great in the kingdom. Now, the third thing he said a child in their midst. Secondly, he said, you've got to change. The change you've got to have, verse 4, is beyond. But look at verse 4. Therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. You've got to be humble. Humble yourself, he said. Now let's talk about the word humble. What does the word humble mean? It means to bring low, Strong says. To reduce to the plain. Same concept of taking hills and making plains out of them. Bringing them down. It means to bring down one's pride. The question implied that there was an inflation of pride. Who is the greatest? They were disputing among themselves. Particularly James and John had this attitude, I want to sit on the right hand or the left, and one of us on one side and one on the other. We've got to be in chief spots if we can, and let's get Mama to go and ask if we can get there. And he said, that's got to change. Got to humble yourself. What Jesus is doing is striding at the heart of their pride and their ambition and telling them that they're wrong. Now notice what he said. You need to be humble as a little child. What does he mean by that? Well, a child does not lift himself up above others. Not the child of this age that you could pick up in your arms. He doesn't lift himself up above others. He doesn't arrogantly parade around, I'm the greatest. The child doesn't do that. The child accepts others. They're most accepting. And they recognize their dependence upon others. They have a need for others. And you've got to be like this little child. The child doesn't hold grudges. Jesus is saying, this is a mark of greatness. You want to be great in the kingdom? Greatness is not being singled out as one who is most important in the kingdom and is so valuable that no one can live without them. But greatness has to do with humility, he says. This is all about greatness in the kingdom. He is answering their question. One writer aptly said, that's very hard to do because looking down on others is easy, as the disciples had been doing, but looking down on yourself when you think of position and role in the kingdom is hard. It's hard to do. Get the point that Jesus is making about humility. Jesus is saying that without humility, you will not even get in the kingdom. Let alone, as Barnes says, have big places in it. What a rebuke he gave to the disciples. He's telling them that you've got to change your whole attitude and the whole way of thinking. You're thinking of promotion in the kingdom and great important places, and if you don't humble yourself and become a little child, and if you don't change, you won't even get in the kingdom, much less have a prominent place there. You've got to completely and utterly change. Now, let's begin in verse 5 and notice the third and final thing. The question of verse 1, who is the greatest? The answer was, look at this little child. You're going to have to change and be like that. Become humble. Or you won't even make it in the kingdom. But beginning at verse 5, there are some warnings that he gives. And what Jesus does, he addresses two possible fears that would come. Now, put yourself in the place of the disciples. You've misunderstood the nature of the kingdom, and if you could picture the kingdom much like the political scene of our day, and if you were a politician, right now we're, what, at 2013, and everybody's got their eyes on 2016. And if this one makes it, or that one makes it, reckon I would get a cabinet position. Wow. Maybe if I kind of help this fellow out, or help that woman out over there, maybe if I help some people out, I'll get promoted and I'll get in a prominent spot. And then suddenly you get this rebuke from the Lord saying, you've got it all wrong. You've got it all wrong. This is not what the kingdom is about. There's two possible fears you might have. One is that if I humble myself like you just described, I might not be accepted. If I'm going to get a prominent place in the kingdom, looks to me like I need to promote myself a little bit. Like George Bush's mama listened to him give a campaign speech one time. The older George Bush. And his mama said, you talk too much about yourself. Well, that's what you do in a campaign speech, isn't it? You talk a lot about yourself. You promote yourself. But if I humble myself, you see, it might be that I won't be accepted. I need to promote myself if I'm going to make it somewhere in the kingdom. And here's a second fear. If I humble myself, I'm going to have people trampling all over me. And I might be abused. Jesus addresses both fears. Now, let's talk about the little child. Beginning at verse 5, whoever receives this little child, and then later mentions in verse 6, the little ones, what's he talking about? It has to do with an humble disciple because he has identified the humble disciple of verse 4 with like this little one. And so he's talking about an humble disciple. Context demands, I think, that conclusion. So here's the first thing. Verse 5, he said, you need to receive one another. Now, this is the way it is in my kingdom, Jesus is saying. Look at verse 5. Whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me. Now, you're not just talking about little children. I don't think his point in the context is, by the way, let's talk about how you ought to treat children. You ought to take little children that you can pick up in your arms and receive them and accept them. Don't reject them. And if you do that, you're going to be great in the kingdom. That's not what he's saying. He's saying the person who receives and accepts the humble servant of the Lord. Look again at the context. Whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me. What's his point? Well, let's see what his point is at verse 5. Let's talk about receiving the little child or the little one. It means to encourage. It means to approve. To love and treat with kindness. That's the idea of receiving one another. To receive one is a sign and a symbol of humility. That if you become like a little child and you humble yourself, those who would receive you, that's a sign of their humility. Furthermore, this idea of receiving others and embracing other people rather than promoting yourself all the time is a sign of your humility. The kind of humility Jesus is describing is not so much self-promoting, where the disciples, I want the great position in the kingdom, but it's embracing others and their value in the kingdom. That's the point. Of verse 5. The way we treat others is the way we treat Christ. That's the point of verse 5. If you receive the little child, you receive me, he said. The way you treat the child is the way you treat me. The way you treat the humble disciple is the way you treat me. Now, Jesus is saying that if you seek looking out for yourself and look at others, you're not going to suffer, but you're going to be blessed. That's his point. There seems to have been this fear that we just talked about, that there's fear of, that what if I humble myself, I won't be accepted, and yes, you will be accepted. You're going to be received by me, and you're going to be accepted by others. So let go of that fear. Here's a second fear. What if I humble myself, I might be mistreated by other people then? So he addresses that in verses 6 through 9. Don't offend someone else. Let's talk about what that means, beginning at verse 6. In fact, let's read again, just verses 6 through 9. Short reading. Then whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, now obviously he's not talking about this little child because he's not capable of sinning. He's talking about the humble servant who becomes like a little child. It would be better for him that a millstone were hung around his neck and that he would drown in the depth of the sea. And woe to the world because of offenses, for offenses must come. But woe to the man through whom offenses come. If your hand or foot causes you to sin, cut it off. And cast it from you. It is better for you to go through life maimed or lame rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into everlasting fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life with one eye than having two eyes to be cast into hellfire. And let's see what we just read there. Let's talk about the word offend. The word offend here is not the idea of hurt feelings, as we've talked about in Romans 14 just recently. Or thinking that someone should not have done something. Someone does something that I don't think they should have done. That offends me. That is not the point here. But notice it, verse 6, if you cause them to sin, it is the idea of causing or leading to sin. That's how you offend them. You offend them by causing them or leading them to sin. Now, how is it that you could offend them? Well, we might offend them in a number of ways. We might offend them in the sense that we encourage them to sin. How do I encourage them to sin? I might tell someone, well, you know what you ought to do. Well, what I'm telling them may be wrong. You know that person that did you wrong? I tell you what you ought to do. You ought to go back and get even with them. I've just encouraged them to sin, hadn't I? I'm encouraging them to do contrary to the will of God. I might encourage sin, and I cause them to offend. I might, by defending one in sin, when someone has done something wrong, well, he had to do that. He just had to do that. I don't know of anything else he could have done but that. And so I defend him in that. And I protect him in his sin. I might cause him to feel rejected as per the context. Like he's unimportant. I'm more important than he is. And you are useless and you are of no value in the kingdom. It might be because of contentions, like the context talks about, that gives offense. I want you to notice, beginning at verse 7, now he talks about the consequences of offending. The consequence of that is, he said, it would be better that a millstone, large stone, so large that it was turned by a donkey at the mill. It would be better for him that a millstone were hung around his neck, tied to his neck, and he were thrown into the depths of the sea. That would be better for him. Because all happens then is he loses his physical life. Because if you cause someone to sin, he said, you'll be cast into everlasting fire. Verse 8, verse 9 calls that hell fire. Fire that burns forever and forever. Well, that's a brief look at verses 1 through 9. We'll pick up at verse 10 in another study and talk about other principles of our relationship. But what have we seen in Matthew chapter 18, verses 1 through 9? The question was, who is the greatest? What a question to ask. But you know, we're asking the same question, aren't we, sometimes? What a surprising answer Jesus gave to set a child in the midst and said, you've got to change. And if you don't, you won't even be in the kingdom. What you need is humility. You need a big dose of humility. Well, if we do that, that could cause some problems. Well, there's two things I want to address about that, he said. And try to lay those fears that you have about humility so that you'll have the humility that I'm trying to drive. And that serves as a basis for the relationship that he's going to talk about through the rest of the chapter. You master that, verses 1 through 9. You can handle all the rest in Matthew chapter 18. There is maybe one or more present who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come all together? We stand and while we sing.